The Millennial Musician Podcast is proud to be sponsored by Funkadelic Studios. Located in the heart of Times Square, Funkadelic isn't just a studio, it's my creative sanctuary where I've spent countless hours perfecting my sound and making priceless connections with fellow artists. With a wide range of gear from iconic brands like Marshall, Fender, and Roland, Funkadelic has been the go-to for over 30 years to both brand new and veteran musicians. With their commitment to supporting local talent and fostering a sense of community, Funkadelic Studios is more than a destination, it's a movement. And did I mention it's the only woman-owned rehearsal studio in New York? To rehearse, record, rent or repair equipment, attend a workshop or a jam, and more, call Funkadelic Studios at 212-696-2513 or visit funkadelicstudios.com. For more information.
There's people who could do it with their instruments, but the voice is the absolute primary way that it goes from a really high quality level of entertainment to an emotional experience that people don't forget.
Are you totally overwhelmed with navigating your music career by yourself? Then you've come to the right place. My name is Shay Leonia, and I'm a professional singer, recording artist, and music career strategist. On this show, I share my expertise from the last 20 years in the music industry, along with some tips that I give my clients every single day. You'll also get to hear from some pretty badass guests. Get ready for some chutzpah and a lot of oversharing. It's time for the Millennial Musician Podcast. It is so good to be back. I am really excited today because I'm finally getting to bring you an episode that I've wanted to record since I first launched this podcast. The reason why is because no matter where I go to listen to music marketing podcasts, not once have I gotten to hear an episode that highlights the fan experience. It always talks about what we think the fan experience would be, or it refers to us as musicians as being fans as well and what we enjoy. But I haven't ever gotten to hear the perspective of a fan who is not a musician. So that's exactly what I'm doing today. I am bringing you my first fan, Mark McLaughlin, who is the polar opposite of who I thought my fan base would be. I just want to give you all the gift of actually hearing from a fan, from their own perspective, about what it is that they appreciate, what they would like for you to avoid, how to make things up to them if things go awry. Like, I really wanted to dive into those things. Now, Mark is also, by trade, a brilliant marketer. So you're going to hear a lot of weaving in and out of the conversation of what his personal preferences are versus what he knows to be good marketing practices. So I think you're, in a way, you're going to be getting a twofer in this episode, but it is easily going to be one of the most important episodes that you can listen to. And I know that when I was hearing him speak, there were so many gems that I was grabbing that I know you all will appreciate. And there were so much between the lines, and it was just really fascinating. This was such a great self-serving episode, but I hope that you all get the insight from it that I intended you to. Now, if this episode is something that you appreciated and that you found helpful, please let me know. I would be happy to bring on other fans and to continue this process. So without further ado, Mark McLaughlin. Aside from bringing on Janet Jackson, I think this might be the most important episode that you could possibly be listening to because I'm talking with my very first fan, Mark McLaughlin. Thank you so much for coming on the show and for taking the time out. First of all, I just want to pass the mic to you to just tell us a little bit about who you are.
All right. My name's Mark McLaughlin, and I'm not a musician, but I'm just a huge fan of music. I am not religious. I have a very complicated religious history in my Irish side, and my family is Jewish. I respect religion, but I am spiritual. And I very much believe we're all connected as humans in ways that you cannot reduce to science and that are deep in our DNA. And there's a reason when we look at the ocean, we all feel things we don't understand, or as I am lucky enough right now, look at mountains. And music is the evidence. Music is the reason that I'm absolutely convinced that we are spiritually connected in a way that's bigger than language can explain. And I feel connected to people. I feel connected to artists. in very powerful ways because of music. And it keeps me young. It keeps me joyful. It helps me through the entire range of emotions, including you. And we'll, I'm sure, talk more about this. But one step at a time, I fell deeper and deeper in love with music as I became an adult. I was a rock guy, you know, I was a 70s and 80s rock guy. But the other thing that happened was I really got into the history of American music. So while I can't tell you what key something is in, I can almost always hear historical connectedness. American music has a way of working itself all the way back to the Port of New Orleans in 1890. Almost all music, two exceptions that I can think of are Zydeco and bluegrass, but setting those aside for a moment, everything came out of the Port of New Orleans. And before the internet, I taught myself the history of music working backwards to listening to Led Zeppelin and then realizing, oh, Chess Blues in Chicago is where they got almost all their material. Mm-hmm. And where the blues come from. And as you study that stuff, you work your way down the Mississippi River, because a famous saying about music in the United States is the river in reverse. And what that refers to, Alan Toussaint did an album with Elvis Costello called The River in Reverse. And what that refers to is how music worked its way against the flow of the Mississippi River slowly up into America. That's a lot of rambling for your first question, but that's who I am. That's why I'm here, I think.
I think it's important to make this distinction that I'm going to reveal to everyone why I brought you on the show in just a moment. But I just want to mark out the distinction clearly that while you are not a musician, you are very well musically educated on the history.
I think
so. Is that fair to say?
I like to think so.
I think everybody's going to be in agreement with me when they hear that mini lesson you just gave. I'm blown away. This is incredible, but I would expect nothing less from you. So the reason why I wanted to bring you on is because there's so much speculation, especially these days with digital marketing, about what it is that the fan wants and what it is that the fan thinks and how they perceive us and perceive our marketing. And what it is that actually constitutes a fan. And I have just always wanted to bring you on and have this conversation with you because you are so educated on things like marketing and music history, and because you feel music so deeply. I really just want to ask the fan themselves. And I just could think of no one better to ask these questions to than you.
Let's take that in order, because what your listeners don't know is my whole career was in advertising and marketing and big brands. Mm-hmm. And so I've talked to a lot of independent artists about what it means to be a brand. And I think that has a little bit of a negative connotation a lot of times when I first bring it up. But what it means to be a brand is to just think really hard about who you are from the point of view of the fan. And there's an awful lot of room to be true to your art and committed to your art and passionate to your art, while also thinking about who you are from a fan's point of view. And in this day and age where artists build their business side one baby step at a time, doing small shows, capturing email addresses, which you have taught people and are very good at, and email's old, but it matters. The gesture that somebody wrote down an email address in their own mind has now connected you to them in a powerful way, even if they don't open emails a lot. Okay.
I want people to hear this, please, because so many people are listening to this thinking like, oh, I haven't started my email list yet. And we're just diving into the questions, everyone. I went around and I gathered a bunch of questions from people. So I'm so glad that we're getting started on this topic. The email marketing thing, people are so often thinking, oh, I don't want to bother anyone. Oh, people don't read emails anymore. Oh, they don't want to give me their email. So you're saying that it's still today in 2024, still valid to get emails.
Why not? Why not? I think that there may be modern and better ways to do it. But certainly when you're starting out, if you have that pad, if you have a friend walking around getting people to fill it out, just that action is connecting some percent of every audience to you in a way that's going to be more memorable. If they wind up following you on Instagram, they'll remember after they've left the show your name better because they did that. I just hung out in Nashville for a long weekend watching independent artists I've never heard of. In Nashville, everyone has a custom poster. Everyone I saw, these are young artists. And the poster has that big QR code. And sometimes it immediately gives you a way to follow on Instagram. But I saw one artist who had to follow them on Instagram on their poster. And under it, was a QR code, and she's performing in a big food cafe. This is like starting your career. She was from Australia. And when you took a picture of the Venmo, the QR code, it brought up Venmo, and you put a small tip in and told her what song you'd like her to play next. So she's getting, you know, $5 here, $2 there. And like many artists, although she's there making money as a writer and she's there to focus on her own music, She's really good at covering lots of songs. And as better than me, there's a way to bring stuff up on your phone these days that help really good artists. And she did her damn best to cover it. And me and my buddy were like texting stuff. Oh, this will be way outside her comfort zone. And Creep, she did Creep, which was not a song you'd expect her to do. And she did a PG version of it because it was a food crowd with families and stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't even want to say how much me and my buddy ended up tipping her over the period of an hour. They were just tactics to give, to make it easy for the people who were most engaged to really have a bigger experience. And And I follow her on Instagram now.
I think I want people to take away from that story is that it's not just a choice of like, where am I going to have people follow me? It's, can I create an experience out of this? Out of something that is seemingly so mundane, it's tipping the performer.
Marsha Ball, unbelievable stride piano player, very famous in Louisiana. She's now a little older than me. Samantha Fish, a blues rock star now. Big time successful. When I first saw her, she was just scrambling and learning from other artists. I bring up both of them because they shell out 300, 400 person venues in New York City very quickly. At the end of their show, after having left blood, sweat, and tears on the stage, they are right off the stage in their clothes, still sweaty, right to the merch table. Don't care if you buy anything. I'm there for a picture for everybody. People are lined up very fast. And that level of humility and that level of commitment, you're the most tired person in the room, and boom, you are at the merch table as fast as the first fan can get there.
Yes.
It's a huge thing to do. And Samantha Fish now does shows so big where that's no longer possible. But I'll be damned if that commitment didn't help her build an unbelievably loyal following.
Mm-hmm.
I think controlling your destiny as an artist today is building a bigger and bigger awareness of who your fans are and what their zip code is. You know, if you want to play the Gray Eagle in Asheville, which is a small venue, and you don't have a local following, your ability to demonstrate that you know 100 fans with zip codes in the Asheville area will make 100% difference whether the Gray Eagle would book you. I think building that very small database that grows a little bit all the time is a very powerful asset as you start to make the case for yourself that you should be compensated better and that you can help sell tickets. As you want people to, what's it called, pre-save your song in Spotify. So that first day you pop on Spotify. All of these things build iteratively.
I know that people are going to be taking notes on this. I really do want to dive into the fan things. Now, the first thing that I want to just explain to people is you get to be honest with yourself about when you first start performing, your first several, maybe even first couple of years, you're going to be performing to a crowd of friends and family only. The reason why I have made the distinction that you, Mark, were my first fan is because you were the first person that started showing up for me in a very consistent way and a very powerful way to me that I didn't know. I didn't know you. And prior to that, I had done the ABCs of music marketing, where they tell you to come up with who your fan avatar is and decide what their demographics are. And that has always rubbed me the wrong way, but I never had given myself permission to disregard it. And so when I came up with my demographics, I'm thinking, okay, I'm doing like R&B pop music. Traditionally, this is an urban genre. I feel like I'm going to have people from the BIPOC community show up to support my music. They're probably going to be around my age. They might be women. They might be. And up appears this gentleman from a wiser age bracket who is.
This old white guy. This old white guy shows up and he's going nuts in the fan crowd. It's okay to say it.
And it really, you were the reason why I was like, you know what? I think it's time to start paying attention to psychographics. And to throw the demographics out the window, I really started honing in on making sure that I was having and establishing that connection, that deeper connection. And lo and behold, every email that I put out, you would respond to. Every cause that I put it out to my audience about something that I want them to support, you would support to it if you could. If I was having a show and you were able to make it, you would more than likely be there. And it just really proved me wrong. And I'm wondering, what in there do you think that people can learn from about the avatar?
So let's hope there's some lessons, but I'm a misfit. Very I don't true. See a lot of guys like me, you know, when I'm going to fill in friends doing Grateful Dead stuff, I look around mm-hmm. and everybody looks like me. But when I'm out in small venues searching for artists like you, I don't look around and see a lot of guys like me. But I think when people are in the audience, if your goal is to create some kind of passionate, energetic engagement between your fans and yourself. And mm-hmm. people ask me about my favorite genre. And my favorite genre is that artist willing to be vulnerable. Are they willing to leave blood, sweat, and tears on the stage in order to deliver the song?
Because, that's the genre.
Because if there's a couple of mistakes, if their voice isn't Broadway perfect, none of that matters if the emotional power gives me goosebumps. And thought about a song to exemplify that we all know, Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen. Mm-hmm. A lot of artists cover that song. I'm not a musician, so I shouldn't really say that. It's not that hard to learn how to sing that song, but it is one of the ultimate tests of, are you creating goosebumps?
It's an absolute litmus test, yes. Yeah.
And I don't know if you know the name Mika Pauly, for example. She was very successful at the level of Rockwood Music Hall. She had twin children and she got out of the business. But she did a version of
Hallelujah. She's the one that you sent me the video that
yes.
blew me away. Yes. Yeah.
She was filling in for a rock band on a Saturday night at the last minute at Rockwood. The crowd was a bunch of white guys who came out of good colleges and working in the business world who were drinking and noisy, and some had their dates and had expected to see a rock show. And she's there solo at the last minute with her guitar. I was a fan of hers, just like I am a fan of yours. And she gets angry. She gets angry when people aren't paying enough attention because she feels like she's working hard. And she looked me in the eye and she stopped and she played Hallelujah and the friggin' place went totally silent. And you had people in tears. And it's because the magic is that ability to go deep inside your own head, take a really big risk in terms of emotional vulnerability, and have that come out through your voice. And not yeah. everybody has to do it to the extreme of that example, but what you're doing when you're trying to make it great in the studio for Spotify or whatever is very different, I think, than what you want to be doing when you get on stage. And we both know lots of really good singers who really impress you with their skills on stage, but don't necessarily tip you emotionally. I don't think it's because, this is very much projecting, but I don't think it's because they can't. I think it's because they're still evolving and still getting more and more comfortable with the vulnerability of really letting their voice show something that's much deeper going. There are people who can do it with their instruments. Dwayne Allman playing guitar. There's people who could do it with their instruments, but the voice is the absolute primary way that it goes from a really high quality level of entertainment to an emotional experience that people don't forget. And I'll tie that to marketing and say, one of the best ways as you're trying to get good at that is to play some of your own songs and then have covers that you can be true to the cover and true to yourself because you love it, but it's a way for the crowd to wake up and identify with you a song they already know and feel it in a very powerful way that's tied to that artist. Nothing helps you go viral than a great job covering a song that everybody already knows. If I see an artist and I think they're fantastic, but I'm seeing them for the first time and they only do their own music, it's really hard for me to say, hey, buddy, I just saw this artist last night. Her name or his name is X. And it's so much easier if I say, man, we got to go search for the cover that she's doing of Howley, right. whatever it might be.
Right.
You did a show. I was trying to remember the specifics and my memory is too blurry, but you did a show at Rockwood. And it was like a rock thing. I think it was a fundraiser. Mm-hmm. Ashton was there. You know, all your great friends were there. Misty, I think, was there. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And what song did you cover? A song, and I was out of my chair hollering.
It was Four Non Blondes. What's up?
Oh my God. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. First of all, what a great song. What a great song. And what a great opportunity for an artist to have lyrics and music that really help you go to an emotionally powerful place. And you were doing song and I was like, oh shit. And it's like an out-of-body experience for me when it really gets
right.
And fans don't forget those experiences.
Yeah. I have, if anybody wants to pause this episode and go to my Instagram page, I have one of the pinned videos, I think, is of your reaction I'm singing that.
This is a while ago, but you posted a video just of you performing it, you and the band performing it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh shit, I can hear myself screaming. It's not really helping the sound quality.
But I love it so much. There are two things that make me so happy when I see video footage. The first thing is if I see somebody dancing in the crowd. And the second thing is if I hear somebody not even able to control the sonics of their reaction. And you're one of those people that I can count on. Because I think that a lot of fans don't necessarily know that when you're on stage, a lot of times it's very hard to get out of your head. And sometimes those thoughts are running wild. It could be anywhere between what do I do with my hands to all of a sudden, oh, I don't think they're liking this. They're not really responding. They're sitting still. They are poker faced. But you, whenever you would be like, yeah, I would just suddenly those thoughts would just shut up and I'd be like, nope, Mark loves it. It's good. Let's keep going. So thank you for those boisterous reactions.
I think about live performance as an exchange of energy between the artist on the stage and the crowd. And
totally.
The artist has the benefit of amplification so that they can create the same amount of energy that 500 people on the other side can create. Mm-hmm. But I like to believe that the energy coming from the 500 makes a huge difference in whether the energy coming from 1 to 5 people gets to its best place. You watch giant concerts with 50,000 people, it's an energy exchange. But when you combine that energy with amplification, now you get a match with 50,000 people giving energy back. To me, when it's right, that energy exchange is what makes live music so spectacular.
So well said. Now, I would love to go down this list of thoughts that I collected from people that they want to know how you feel about these things. Let's start with when the show doesn't run on time. To elaborate first before we dive in, there was a show that I did, I want to say it was 2017, where I was asked to do the show. It was the first time I'd ever done the show. I didn't do my due diligence in attending one of the shows before agreeing to participate in it. And so I didn't realize that one of the cons of the show is that it did not run on time. And you had shown up, I believe, with your daughter. And it just was going on. And every time they would say, Shay, you're up next to perform, somebody else would go on, and then suddenly a poet would go on stage, and it was just like, oh my gosh. And all I could think about was, oh my gosh, Mark is going to either leave or he's never going to come to another show of mine again. When that happens, what can somebody do to salvage the situation with their fan?
I would say the most important thing there is when you are sending out emails or whatever to promote it, try to be very aware that's the situation. I think subsequently you did some events where your email said, hey, it's that kind of a vibe. I have my quirks, but I'm not narcissistic. I'm not sitting there thinking, oh, me and my daughter. I'm sitting there thinking, oh, I feel so bad for Shay. She had all these expectations, and look what's happening. I think it's an important question. Fans understand the context. If it's the daytime stages at Jazz Fest, or if it's the old Rockwood Music Hall, boom, 50-minute sets. Everything's runs like clockwork. Go from Jazz Fest, where every 50-minute show is tight and starts on the minute, because if you don't, you ain't coming back. Even the artists are sober because it's so precise. And then you go to see them at a 10 o'clock show that night in the French Quarter or somewhere in New Orleans, and they come on at 11:30. But That's what you expect when you go out to a late night venue in New Orleans and it says 10 o'clock show. That's so the bar can sell drinks for an hour. So I think passionate fans put it in context. I think the only thing is to do your best to try to, fans want to know when you're playing, and sometimes it's an informal situation. I love it more down here, and certainly in Nashville, you find singer-songwriter things where you know that somebody you're a big fan of is going to be one of five guitar players on a stage sitting around a table, and you don't know how much they're going to play. If you go there just for them, you're making a mistake anyway. I'm a big fan of a guy named Chris Jacobs. If Chris Jacobs is sitting there with three other guitar singer songwriters, I know they must be peers of his. So I'm going to enjoy it all. And I don't know how much I'm going to get of him. So context is everything.
I'm going to elaborate on that and just say, because there are some genres that really do a great job of vetting to make sure that if there is going to be a songwriter circle performance, that all the people on stage are pretty much in the same bracket.
Oh, yeah.
But then there are other shows where it's clearly they're, in my opinion, they are exploiting a new artist, and they will throw anybody up on there who has paid for a slot, and you never know what you're going to get. And sometimes their set is only going to be 10 minutes, but the tickets could be charging $20 and it's like a 3-hour night. And so I think the point that you made about like really being good about being upfront and communicating with your fans about this beforehand so that they know what to expect. And yeah, do your fan the favor of finding out when are you anticipating your slot to be, if that's something that you can find out. I think that's fair.
I think that's fair too. I think the ultimately sloppy venues,
yeah,
have as much to lose as any artist. Later in life, I've really tried to understand the music business. I learned as I came to understand what artists deal with. The owners of music venues often don't give a shit about music.
Not at all. Yeah.
That stuns me. Do something else with your retail space. Now, I'm speaking for myself here, but I can feel the difference between a venue that's musician friendly and one that's not. I can just feel it. It's awkward and uncomfortable in places that aren't musician friendly. I think maybe in urban cities like New York, it's a bigger problem. There's less ambition and more passion in places like Asheville. Nashville with an N is different, but I think it's still more true. If you're going to have a music venue in Nashville or Asheville, probably love music and love musicians. Yeah. But it's stunning to me to read biographies of artists and stuff. One of the biggest problems is the owners of music venues could care less about the artists. That has blown me away.
It's an unfortunate truth that has stood the test of time. For sure.
When I lived in the city and my kids were younger, we lived in Westchester, and I would drive in to see music at Rockwood Music Hall and have a couple of drinks early and then stop for a few hours because I had to drive home. But the irony that I paid $35 to park my car and $10 to go in and see you was never lost on me. The parking venue doesn't get the $35 if it's not for you and your many wonderful peers. It's a tough business. I'm very empathetic and very aware of what it took just to get your butt up on that stage, how hard it is on a personal level, and whether you're ready to be as vulnerable as I was talking about earlier or not, you're vulnerable. Then you got half the people in the room just happen to be there to drink and talk and do whatever. You got a venue that could care less about you. You got a sound check that didn't go well and a sound guy who's late or whatever. I actually love all of that, even though it's painful to try to be watching from an artist's point of view. And let me segue on something. Why do I love all of that? There's a guy named Jim Dickinson who's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He helped produce some of the Rolling Stones music from Exile on Main Street and stuff like that. His sons, Luther and Cody Dickinson, formed North Mississippi All-Stars, which is a pretty well-known band in Americana genres. But Jim Dickinson has passed away. He went through college in the world where LSD was legal and colleges were testing it on kids. He was a spectacular artist as a musician and as a painter and as a poet. He just was an artist. And he said something that is a rhetorical question, but it became something he was obsessed about. And the question was, is art the thing that is created, or is art the process of creating the thing? Now, it's a rhetorical question because it's both. But as I try to be self-aware about my own passion for music, when I was young, it was the friggin' song. It was the song. As an older fan, the process of creation from what went on in the studio, what is that artist's life all about? Who are they? What's their background? The process of creation in a live environment. Man, it is technically hard. It is logistically hard. It is financially hard. And to see what's going on a stage with a tight band 15 minutes before the show starts, and then boom, the drummer hits boom, and it's as tight as could be. That's all process creation. And at this stage of my life, I get as much passion and engagement and excitement from the process that goes into creating art as I do from the outcome.
Wow. I relate to that so heavily because I'm definitely somebody who, whenever I watch a movie, as soon as I finish it, I run to imdb.com and read the trivia. I get it. I'm thinking of, because you mentioned the sound guy, and I'm thinking of how the first show that you came to of mine, you probably weren't aware, but the sound person came to me and told me in the dressing room that he hates my drummer and that I should have never hired him because apparently they had this long seated history together. So the sound guy had the chutzpah to tell me, go up on stage and sound check. So these are like the little things that are happening right before a performance that the people in the audience have no idea about. Oh gosh. Yeah. The behind the scenes is definitely, it's where it's at. The process is where it's at. So you were mentioning about being very cognizant about the lack of economic fairness in the music world. I would love to hear from you because so many artists are encouraged to make merch. Is there a type of merch that you tend to go for? I know that you're going to be speaking on your behalf, but just so that people can hear like what people want.
I think CDs are dead. Let's start there. To support an artist, I will buy the CD, even though I'm never going to play the music from the CD. I have maybe 70 CDs that I will always have because they're signed by people that I care about. It's really important to have some basic things. A sticker that can go on a car or a computer or a water bottle that costs $2. A t-shirt, a baseball cap, something that if somebody buys it, you can sign. I have, so Samantha Fish, good example because I brought her up before. Pretty early on, I saw her at a show in New York. I was already a big fan. And I go and I buy a shirt with her on it. I go to the bathroom, I put the shirt on, and then wait in line just to say hi and get a picture. And I say, I already put the shirt on. Would you mind signing it? And she says to me, I've been asked to sign boobs before, but this is the first time I ever signed my own boobs. On the one hand, I remember a guy, I bought his t-shirt and he's, thanks, Mark. You probably already know this, but the money I'm going to make from $25 for that t-shirt is more money than I'm going to make from Spotify maybe in my whole life. But I think that the dynamic of getting to the merch table, not caring a bit about whether somebody is buying something or not, but if they want a picture, man, give them a picture. And if they want to chat a little bit, the art of not letting that one person take up 10 minutes of your time when there's 30 people in line may be tricky because there are those kinds of selfish people, but a merch table gives you a reason to get out off the stage right away. And that alone is why you want to have some basics covered. Vinyl's remarkable. I think you have to have an instinct for the upfront investment versus the value you can get. And I think you need to have a certain amount of momentum in your career and a certain amount of passionate fans, because my guess is 80% of vinyl sales are fans who are never going to actually get that record out and put it on a turntable. And
it's also very long lead time. It's about a year out right now.
Even this is obsolete, but somebody used to, if you bought a $25 t-shirt, you got a little thumb drive with the album on it. Now, but that was really cool when we were still loading our songs into iTunes on our hard drive. Even that's obsolete. So I think in this world of streaming, having something else that's tangible and having a few price points, and if somebody comes up and says, geez, do I have to pay $2 for a sticker? hell no, let's take a picture. Go ahead, take. They're going to put it on. They're going to put it on something. They're going to go into advertising on your behalf with that sticker.
Right.
I would never put stickers out there without a little price under it, and I would never just hand them out because they might wind up in the garbage. But yeah, if somebody says, geez, do I really have to pay you $2? Your show is great. Do I really have to pay $2 for a sticker? Hell no, let's take a picture.
I've always loved the pay what you want model.
Bandcamp is that. I'm such a sucker. Shannon McNally. I became a big fan when she did an album called Black Irish. I'm Black Irish. But emotional, talented singer-songwriter who has been associated in way as a muse with a lot of great, well-known musicians. When they were in trouble with heroin, when they were in trouble with stuff, she was there trying to help some musicians I know very well. Anyway, she's selling her album on Bandcamp for $20. I paid $40 for it. I now have a signed CD and I stream it. So the way Bandcamp works, the last thing I want is another different way that I have to go in and stream music. But for your good fans or fans who want to support you, especially if it's tied to something a little bigger than just producing the album, all of that stuff is good. All of it is good.
It really sounds like you just want people to understand the importance of fans getting an excuse, almost like a tangible excuse, to have that moment with the artist afterwards. I will never forget that picture of you and Mishti with you holding up her poster. Such a great picture. Such a great picture. I love it. It's one of my favorites.
By the way, how is Mishti, first of all?
Mishti's doing good. She just had her birthday show at Parkside Lounge. I wasn't able to attend because I was still under the weather, but yeah, she's doing great.
She's a good example of somebody who has a crystal understanding of who she is as a brand.
Yeah.
When she's on stage, there's only one Mishti. And
there really is.
And she's a fascinated and complicated woman in her life, and I don't know her that well, and a larger-than-life personality in her own way.
Yes.
But Mishti gets on stage. She has a look. She has a way of playing guitar. She has a way of kicking ass with every song she delivers. Anyway, it'd be great to see a show with her again.
Yeah, she's been playing out a little bit. So I should let you know for the next time you're up this way. Do you ever find yourself going to an artist's website, or does that not matter so much to you? Is it more that you just want correspondence via email or social media? Like, how does that work for you?
100%. I go to an artist's website.
Do you read their bio?
Absolutely.
There we go. You heard it here.
The other thing that everybody should do on their website is have a link to playing the song and the lyrics underneath on your page, because one of the easiest ways that people are stealing traffic from you are those lyrics find sites. And it's much harder for them to get away with posting your lyrics and having searches wind up at lyricsfind.com or whatever the hell these things are called. It's much harder for them to get away with that if your lyrics are crystal clear and posted on a page on your website.
I need to do that. That's a great suggestion.
You know who Beth Hart is?
No.
She took me aside because I got into a conversation before a show with her about, I was starting at Fly, and I talked to her about how frustrating the situation was with Spotify. And she's, you know what, Mark? I'll figure that out. But these people stealing traffic to my website because they're taking my lyrics and posting them and paying for search to get out in front when somebody searches on my song title, that's outrageous. Go back and fix that for me. When people search on your name, and now look at my demographic, okay? A lot of people will make the case, hey, if I'm doing it right on Instagram and I'm doing it right on TikTok, investing in a website is so much work, so much expense. I'm not sure that they're wrong. I don't know. But to me, a website's very valuable. To me, when I search on a name, I don't just want to now be able to follow them on Instagram. I want to learn more. If I've seen them at a show that night and it's a first-time discovery, I want to, speaking for myself, I mainly want to follow them on Instagram because I'm likely to hear about the next time they're going to play in Asheville that way, because they didn't get my email address and they're not doing that stuff. But their website is where I'm going to get a bigger picture. I might find more music that I happen to do all my listening on Amazon Music. I love the app. And if stuff is available at a higher level of recording, Ultra HD or Atmos, they will always give that to you if it's available.
I didn't even know that Amazon was equipped for Atmos yet.
Oh, think about how many people are already Amazon Prime members because they get stuff delivered to their homes. And so because I have Amazon Prime, I get Amazon Music for free. Spotify is lowest common denominator bandwidth in terms of how they deliver the music. Whereas Amazon, and this might be true of some of the others, but Amazon degrades down to that level if it recognizes that your bandwidth is such that you're better off just getting the Spotify level of quality. When I'm at home, I'm using Wi-Fi. I want to hear the highest quality possible with these things while I'm on my exercise machine trying to fight old age.
That is incredible. Yeah, I was going to ask you what your preferred listening method is, and I'm so surprised to hear you say Amazon Music.
The frustrating thing was, I think you use it, but you know how now that link to all your links, the Linktree, Linktree.com? First of all, that's a great thing for every artist to be doing, a great thing to find as soon as they get to your website. I think that's such a smart device idea in this world where who the hell knows how people are streaming. But Amazon Music used to be 2 months later, I'll get around to getting it up on Amazon Music. And now it seems like for the most part, people are making their streaming music available right away on Amazon Music. And now get this, this is how silly of a fan I am. I have a subscription to Spotify just because I think that when I constantly go to Spotify to pre-save, to help the artist. So when it comes out, because Spotify is where people really pay attention to the numbers and where those numbers can help you. Let's say one other thing about my demographic. We have disposable income, okay? A huge international artist, Billy Strings, bluegrass musician, but Jerry Garcia was a bluegrass musician. He signed up and he played Jerry Garcia's style guitar in a lot of these Grateful Dead cover bands. I don't really need to go out and see cover bands, but the point I'm making, and I think it matters, is they know they're appealing to people who are now empty nesters and older, who have tons of time and disposable income, and they sell out gigantic venues. Go to a Phish concert, they're selling out Madison Square Garden. A boatload of the reason is older people. I'm not a Phish fan, but a boatload of the reason that they're so successful is they've been doing it for a long time, and a lot of their fans are now old enough that they're bringing their kids who are old enough to drink to those Phish shows.
Yeah.
We are, if we're passionate and we become a fan, we have time and money. I don't want to sound like some kind of billionaire, but you get
my point. I absolutely get your point. And so much of it, a huge reason why I call this the Millennial Musician Podcast is because the generational experience of what we have witnessed in just how the world has changed matters with music. And I think it's such a great point that you're making about having the disposable income, but there's also so much validity to the fact that your generation came up at a time where going and waiting online for concert tickets or calling in the radio show, like you went through all of that. The Gen X, millennials, we witnessed what it was like to wait for blocks around the corner from Tower Records to get a copy of the CD signed. And so today, it's so much more than just like the fact that younger millennials and Gen Z are just trying to pay to survive, let alone being able to afford to go to concerts. But it's also that a lot of them have grown up with just music being so readily accessible that it's not as high stakes to possibly invest in a concert or seeing the person up close, because maybe they can attend an Instagram live of this person and have a chance to chat with them there. So there's so much at play with the generational divides as well.
I agree. And I think you just said something important. I think there are musicians who are very talented and give a lot of energy to complaining about the circumstances. In ways outside of music, what I have said to my kids is a lot of times starting with taking SATs to get into college, knowing full well that SATs are bullshit. I'm like,
I never had to take them. I went to a performing arts school.
Good for you. You would have scored perfect scores on math anyway, I'm sure.
My practice SATs were shit. They were dog shit.
But as you try to transition from a child to an adult, there are real world games out there, and a lot of the games suck. Even how we try to get decent people into Washington to represent us. So you have a choice. You can decide to become angry about the game and rebel against it. Or you could decide, well, that's the fucking game. So I'm going to figure out how to be a winner in that context and still be true to myself. But that's the game. And it involves networking or politics or tests that are crap. The music industry's filled with that. But what I see on the other hand is a ton of artists saying, okay, I have ways to build an audience and keep track of who my followers are. That never existed for the generations before me. Yeah. I have a way to come away from every show and the 10% of people who I won over during that show, I can meet them. I can engage with them and have a way to stay connected with them over time. To the point you were just making that triggered all these thoughts, I can do live streams. The pandemic showed us something that doesn't have to go away. During the pandemic, I can't tell you how many, it really settled down to 2 or 3. But every week, I had nothing to freaking do. I had nothing, like most of us, except yeah. I'm semi-retired, up living on top of a mountain. So I was blessed during the pandemic. But man, that 1 hour every Tuesday night where Chris Jacobs did his show, that was like on the calendar. We don't have that anymore. And people are back to being very busy. But those are tools that if you just decide, I'm going to look at this crazy digital world as a set of tools. And for all of the things that are working against me, I'm going to figure out how to make them work for me. And most of them, some of them I think can be revenue producing. A bunch of them are tools to help you slowly build bigger and bigger audiences to show up for your live shows. Tip, if you can build your following and you can build momentum and you can stick it out for a couple of years and you're damn good and you are leaving your blood, sweat, and tears on the floor every night when you go live, no matter how hard the trip was, you can tip. And making money from live shows is how you can make a living in this business. You don't have to be filling Madison Square Garden. You don't even have to be selling 5,000 tickets. But if you can be selling 200 tickets 4 nights a week as you're going around to venues, you can tip that into a real living.
I want to make sure that I leave enough time to ask you one more question that for some reason has been a debate for a long time. Do you take any personal offense to being referred to as a fan?
No, not at all. I
don't know if that surprises you that people wonder this.
I don't like calling
people fans. They're my friends. And I'm just like,
I think if you're on stage and you're talking about your fans, talking about things like how much energy goes both ways, enhancing what the word means to you as the artist, if you're using that term on stage or something. With me, meeting small independent artists, I'm very cognizant of what is the line between being a fan and being presumptuous that I'm a friend. So from my side, I think about it that way. Look, if a woman is, there's a local artist in New York named Sammy Stevens, S-A-M-I, SammyStevensVoice.com. I've been a fan forever. And very supportive, just like you, show up at all our shows. I was sitting at a bar where she was about to play, and another musician who I didn't know, another woman was at the bar. And I'm just there like this old guy, like acting like a friend. And Sammy turns to the other girl and says, he's a true fan, he's not a creep. Because if it's a guy who I'm a fan of, it's easier if it's a considerably older or gay or married. But a lot of times it's relatively young women who are up there doing amazing things in terms of emotions with their voice and their commitment on the stage. And I'm very self-conscious about where's the line between appearing to be a stalker versus a passionate fan. So that's just me. But no, I don't have a problem with the word fan.
It's such a great point that you make. And I wasn't even thinking you were going to go there, but it's so true. Being a young woman, I'm always having to survey, like, who is it that is frequently coming to my shows? Are they safe? Am I safe around them? Our friendship, fanship has always just organically blossomed in a very comfortable way. But there have unfortunately been men that have come to my shows where I've had to block them. And I've had to tell the venue staff, please make sure this person doesn't come in because they make me feel uncomfortable. And I would say that the way that I found that out was not just listening to my intuition, but also trusting my intuition enough to do some extra research. And I think one of the benefits that we have as independent artists, especially with a smaller fan base, is that we have the time available to us to do the research on who our fans are. And when I did that research, I didn't like what I saw. It just was enough to make me realize, you know what, I want to take these extra precautions. But fortunately, that situation for me has happened few and far between. And someone like you has always been very respectful of boundaries and has never, ever made me feel any type of way.
But I think one of the reasons I'm self-conscious in that sense is a huge percentage of older white guys are assholes.
Absolutely. But the fact that you know that, it just goes to show you your character.
This doesn't really fit on the show, but I've been married 30 years. But when I was dating as a bachelor in New York City, I was dating a stunning woman. And me next to her didn't make a lot of sense. I said to her something about that, just with all the guys that want to pay attention to you, why are we dating? She's, Mark, you have no idea how lame the competition actually is.
Mark, again, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to come on this show. And I understand you're not a podcast listener, but hopefully you'll enjoy what you hear.
So I'll tell you the truth. I think it's because I'm a big reader. I read novels like you can't believe. And when I'm listening, there's just never enough time for all the music in the world that I want to be listening to.
Yeah.
And I came of age before podcasts. When I've been riding as a passenger in a car, my daughter's been playing podcasts or my wife's been playing podcasts. They're really good. But somehow I just haven't quite gotten into it. We're going to make an exception here. I'm going to. Well, you know what? I went to yours and actually, let's give a minute to this because as with many artists like you, I had forgotten where I first crossed paths. And I'll bet it was Fame Cohen.
I'll bet it was Fame.
Slide with the first place where, as an independent consultant, a very senior investor was paying me a few bucks. And I was excited because it was music and I saw the potential in the business. But anyway, quick shout out to her. So I did listen to that podcast of yours. Look, that's why you're so extraordinary. That's why, because you mentioned, I know you well enough, and we won't dwell on this. You have a reason. You have reasons to be careful when a man approaches you or when a man starts to become a fan. I think all your fans probably understand that.
Yeah.
But where I'm going that matters is so much of who you are as an emotional person, the joy and the pain. You bring it to the stage with you. And yeah, I know artists, you're caught up in industry crap. There's so many things in your mind. But once you go, girl. And that's why we're talking. That's why all this has lasted all these years, because there's a part of you that's amazing that's inside of you. And for those in the audience who are there and paying attention, it spills out. That's the genre I love.
Wow. Mark, if no one ever tells you what it means to us as musicians to have you as a fan, as a supporter, let you know it means the world. Before this episode, I was going through some of our old email exchanges and just the times that you've just given me words of encouragement or steered me in the right direction or just supported a cause that meant a lot to me. I just cannot tell you what it means to me. And I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, because without someone like you in my corner, I don't know that I would still be doing music. So thank you.
Thank you for saying that.
I will jot down all of the names of everyone that Mark mentioned so that you can check them out in the show notes. Let me know if this episode was helpful for you. All right, everyone.